Hello again and welcome to the fifth episode of Monsters Among Us, a Filipino-Asian true crime podcast. And this is your host, Chachi. So, hello. We are now on our fifth episode. And in this episode, I was originally planning to feature just one case. But upon researching, I discovered that there are two other cases which are similar to the first one I was supposed to focus on. And so I decided to talk about these three cases all in one episode. So you should brace yourself, probably prepare some coffee if you're at home or get a snack. Or if you're driving facing heavy traffic, just sit back and listen to this episode. Whatever it is, to prepare yourself because this might be a long episode. Okay, so if you're now settled down, I will just go straight to it and introduce the cases that are from my own country, Philippines. Just like our previous episodes, this episode will contain descriptions of scenes that might be sensitive and traumatic to some audience, so listener's discretion is advised. Our sources are from Esquire Magazine, the Manila Times, Filipino.net, the Philippine Supreme Court case files, AP News, ABS-CBN News, and GMA News. Without further ado, let's jump right into the cases. So if you're not a Filipino, you might not know that the Philippines has been colonized by a lot of countries in the past, and one of the countries which probably had the greatest impact on our culture is the United States. Yes, we're colonized by the Americans for 48 years. That's from 1898 to 1946. And they influenced a lot, including our education and our language. Well, Philippines has a lot of languages and dialects depending on where you grew up. I grew up in Manila, so the language we use here is Filipino or the standardized Tagalog. But most of us here, if not all, have English as our second language because that's the language used as a medium of teaching in schools, or sometimes Filipino parents just like to raise their kids speaking English already at home. And because of this, we borrow a lot of English words and use them and create our own meaning. You're probably wondering why I'm starting this episode with some language trivia, but this plays an important part to provide you a context on the case we have today. Because one of the borrowed terms we have is chop-chop. Chop, which according to Oxford Dictionary means to cut something into pieces with repeated sharp blows of an axe or a knife. Filipinos used this word and even doubled it, making it chop-chop, to probably emphasize the meaning of the word. Now, this word, when used, doesn't end with it being doubled. It's usually used together with the word lady. So it becomes chop chop lady. And no, this doesn't refer to a lady in a butcher shop who's in charge in chopping your meat chunks. This term has a horrifying meaning because chop chop lady refers to the women who were not just brutally murdered but also dismembered, and their parts were usually thrown away far from each other. Unfortunately, we don't just have one case of a chop-chop lady in the Philippines, but we have three, and hopefully there won't be a fourth one. As I mentioned, I was only going to feature the first case of the chop-chop lady, but upon researching, I found out that there are two other chop-chop lady cases, so I'm going to talk about all of these in one episode. Let's talk about the original chop-chop lady first, which dates back to 1967. It was so long ago that my father wasn't even born at the time. All the sources were newspaper cutouts. Fortunately, they documented this case enough to be talked about. Let's meet the woman in our first case named Lucila Lalu. Lucila Tolentino Lalu was from Candaba, Pampanga. She lived in a small barrio called Mapaniki, and sometime in the late 1950s or early 1960s, she left her hometown. Just like many others back then, she wanted to try her luck in Manila, the Philippines' capital city, in search for a good life. When she arrived in Manila in 1961, she was able to work as a waitress at a small bar. It is said that she was good with money, so she was able to save her hard-earned money and started businesses. She had two business ventures. The first one was a salon called Lucy's House of Beauty, and the other one was a restaurant that's also a cocktail lounge or nightclub at night, which she named Pagoda. These businesses were in Santa Cruz, Manila. During this time, he also met a police officer named Anyano de Vera. Anyano de Vera was married, but unfortunately, Miss Lucila followed her heart and not her head, and so they went on to live together in a common law marriage, and not too long into the union, they had a son. At 28 years old, Lucila was juggling her businesses and family life quite well. Until she disappeared on the summer of 1967. None of the old newspaper clippings mentioned whether Lucila's family reported her missing. It's probably because they thought she's just busy with her businesses. But on May 28, a garbage collector found human body parts. He found a pair of legs wrapped in a newspaper dated May 14th in a garbage can a few blocks away from Pagoda, Lucila's restaurant. The garbage collector who reported it to the police mentioned that the legs were cold to touch, as if they had come from the freezer, and he also noted that the toes were well pedicured. So he assumed that the legs belonged to someone who is somehow well-to-do. And then, a day later, a headless and legless body, you know, just the torso with the arms, were found along EDSA near Guadalupe Bridge. These parts were also wrapped in a newspaper. However, the date of the newspaper this time was May 23. They were able to lift fingerprints from it and determined it to be Lucila Lalu's body. The news immediately took over the front pages of the newspapers. For the local media, Lucila Lalu's story outranked the Arab-Israeli war at that time. Her case was highly sensationalized because it's very unusual in the 1960s Philippines to find pieces of a human body scattered around Manila. You know, we don't have documented serial killers here who love to dismember bodies, unlike in other parts of the world. So Filipinos found her story scary as fuck because it also took a lot of time for the police to identify the body. Now, who killed Lucila? Homicide investigators said that whoever killed her is someone skilled with a knife or has some sort of medical knowledge because the body parts were expertly cut. He's either a butcher or a surgeon or even a med student. They also said that this person is rich because he was able to store the body parts in a freezer and scatter them in different parts of Metro Manila, so he probably owned a car. In the Philippines back at the time, you must be rich in order to own a refrigerator and a car, so their deductions are logical, especially the freezer. You got to have a big-ass freezer to store a human body. Now, in order to find her murderer, it's important to dig deep into her recent past, and the police were able to name three main suspects, one of which was, of course, her husband, police officer Anyano de Vera. But before naming him, authorities named a different suspect, Lucila's 19-year-old lover, Florian Terrelos, who was also working as a waiter at her Pagoda restaurant. They said that Lucila and Florian's affair was an open secret. Lucila even gave him an apartment and provided his financial needs. He was first arrested because the police believed that he was a probable suspect given the relationship. However, Florian had a solid alibi. At the time of the crime, which was between late Sunday evening and Monday noon according to the results of the autopsy, Florante was drinking with his friends, and his friends corroborated his claim. He did not deny that they were in a relationship and even said that she was very good to him, which is correct because Lucila's been providing for him, so he did not have any motive to kill her. However, the cashier at Pagoda also said that Lucila had already broken up with Florante. During the night of the murder, she also told Florante and his friends that Lucila may be at the beauty parlor if they wanted to see her. Some witnesses even said that they saw her being dragged by Florante and his friends into a taxi in front of the parlor. But these accounts were never verified, so he was freed, but he refused to leave the police station because he feared for his life. This had the police shifted their suspicions to Lucila's common law husband, the police officer Agnano de Vera. He became the second suspect. It is not a secret that Lucila and Agnano were having problems in their marriage. Their child, which was 6 years old at the time, isn't staying with them but with Lucila's mother in Caloocan. When he was named suspect, people weren't really surprised because Agnano was prone to fits of anger and jealousy, enough to make him fire off his service gun not once but three different times in Lucila's pagoda and beauty parlor months before her disappearance. Florante testified that on one of those occasions, Agnano caught him and Lucila hugging each other, and that caused him to fire his gun. Yes, Agnano had the motive, but the police couldn't find any direct evidence connecting him to the crime. Agnano said that at the night of Lucila's disappearance, he had dinner with her in the beauty parlor at about 6:30 p.m. He left immediately after. Some witnesses, including some of Lucila's relatives, said that around the time Agnano left, they even saw her in the salon sleeping. However, this contradicts Florante's earlier testimony that he and Lucila had met around 7:30 the same night in another cocktail lounge on Rizal Avenue. If you were able to listen to my pilot episode, you're probably familiar with the term marites, the name we use for nosy neighbors here in the Philippines. Well, when this case became the cover of the front pages, this had the people of the Philippines became a national marites. As the case developed, the people were more interested in how Lucila lived her life more than finding her murderer. Rumors spread that she had more lovers other than Florante. Testimonies from quote-unquote witnesses poured in about these so-called lovers, and of course, police had to verify each and hunt these so-called lovers. However, the testimonies from the marites witnesses were varied and contradictory. For example, Lucila's neighbors claimed they saw a body getting dragged by three men from Lucila's residence, but Agnano said that he saw Lucila alive and healthy hours after the neighbors reportedly saw a body being dragged away. And then Lucila's friend said she wanted to break up with Florante, but Florante swears they were very much in love with each other, and so on and so forth. With these types of testimonies, the police were leading to nowhere. They can only go back to the initial profile of the murderer, which they thought was intelligent, methodical, professional, and rich. There's also another problem. Lucila's head was still missing. A week passed by, and there's no other viable suspects aside from Agnano and Florante. Then on June 15, 1967, the news broke out that a handsome young man, a son of a retired Philippine constabulary colonel, married and father of five, confessed to the murder because of his guilty conscience. His name is Jose Luis Santiano, a 28-year-old dentistry student. He came forward with a handwritten confession stating that he experienced a mental blackout but remembered strangling Lucila to her death. Jose Luis was apparently also one of Lucila's lovers and was one of the boarders of the spare rooms in her parlor and so he became the third suspect. On his letter, he recounted and detailed the events that led to the brutal killing. He said that Lucila had tried to seduce him, and that when he refused, she threatened to create a scandal. This was when Jose Luis lost his mind and killed her. In his testimony, he even mentioned disposing of the head in Diliman, Quezon City, and carrying parts of the body in paper bags and boxes while commuting in taxis and jeepneys. The investigators had not bothered to check Jose Luis' room because the police assigned to the case said that they did not consider it important. When Jose Luis' room was finally checked, the door was found to have been forced open, which is kind of suspicious. They found traces of dried blood underneath Jose Luis' bed, where he said he kept the body before disposing of it, a kitchen knife, razor blade, and a woman's stockings, supposed pieces of evidence that the fiscal found so unconvincing they had the National Bureau of Investigation take over. It was never mentioned in old news reports if the head was ever found. 3 days later, Jose Luis was singing a different tune. He retracted his earlier statement, saying he wasn't the murderer, but just an unwilling witness to the murder, which was in fact committed by three men. While the murder did happen in the mezzanine of the parlor where Jose Luis' room was, he said that two men killed Lucila, while another man held him hostage while pointing a gun at him. A fourth man appeared the following morning and planted evidence, the blood, in his room. Over the next few days, he allegedly also received notes reminding him to keep silent. And the case was even more muddled when a, quote, mystery witness, Dr. Nora L. Ebio, came forward to testify that Jose Luis was coerced by the investigators into owning up to the crime. But the authorities were firm on their decision to pursue the case against the new suspect. The police insisted that Jose Luis did it, especially since they found the hammer with bloodstains in the mezzanine, as well as the knife and razors in his initial testimony. They claimed that he was merely following his lawyer's suggestion of retracting his statement. When Jose Luis was being held by the NBI, they also received bomb threats to let the murder suspect go. He was released later on, and some even say that Jose Luis is still alive and living abroad. There was another suspect, an executive of a printing firm, who was also said to be Lucila's lover. He was never named in any of the reports, only that he was suspected because of cardboard material used in wrapping newsprints that was found under the torso of Lucila. This mystery man seemed to have an alibi for the night, and this angle wasn't explored any further. With all of this and no additional leads, the case grew cold. But there's a plot twist. In 2003, a former Los Angeles police detective named Steve Hottle published a book called Black Dahlia Avenger, The True Story. Obviously, it's about the case of the murder of Elizabeth Short, also known as the Black Dahlia. The murder happened in 1947 and has never been solved up to this day. Her murder was oddly similar to Lucila Lalu's murder, and in this book by Steve Hottle, he claimed that one of the suspects of the Black Dahlia murder, George Hoddle, his father, was the real killer of Elizabeth Short. Not only that, he mentioned that his father also probably murdered Lucila Lalu. In the book, he detailed what he found out during his 15-year investigation into the Black Dahlia murderer after his father's death. In his investigation, he found out a recording from his father's Hollywood residence where his father said, quote, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They can't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead. They thought there was something fishy. Anyway, now that they may have figured it out, killed her. Maybe I did kill my secretary, unquote. Prior to this, Steve's sister Tamar also claimed that their father was the Black Dahlia murderer. Furthermore, handwriting analysis shows connections between George Huddleston's handwriting and notes written by the lipstick killer and the Zodiac killer. Anyway, going back to Lucila Lalu's case, Steve Huddle found out that after his father abandoned them, George Huddle stayed in Manila, Philippines in the 1960s, matching the time Lucila Lalu was murdered. He suspected his father as the person responsible for Lucila's murder because the crime is very similar to what happened to Elizabeth Short, mutilated and bisected at the waist. So if George Huddle was the real Black Dahlia killer, he's a viable suspect for Lucila Lalu's murder given that he's at the Philippines at the time. Another thing that makes this theory possible is that George Huddle was a physician, clearly very knowledgeable with knives, and of course, rich enough to move back and forth America and the Philippines. He clearly matched the police suspect profile. But of course, it was already 2003 when Steve Huddle mentioned this, and the Philippines isn't as advanced as the United States when it comes to record keeping of crimes and cold cases, so I highly doubt they still keep evidences, if there is any, from Lucila Lalu's murder, so they cannot go back into the case and confirm this theory. And sadly, almost 60 years later, the case officially remains open. No man has been put behind bars for this horrific crime. Whatever really happened remained between Lucila and his killer. What a really sad case. And what's more sad is that the case of the Chop Chop Lady didn't end with Lucila. In 1993, exactly 26 years when the Chop Chop Lady swept the front pages of the newspapers, another Chop Chop Lady surfaced. This is the story of Elsa Castillo. Her story, just like Lucila Lalu, was highly sensationalized, enough for the film industry to create two films out of her story. The first one, the Elsa Castillo story, Ang Katotohanan, or the Elsa Castillo story, The Truth in English, and Chop Chop Lady, the Elsa Castillo story. Both films were released a year after the murder. So what really happened to Elsa Castillo? Let's first talk about her life story. Elsa Santos Castillo was the assistant personnel manager of a company called Apex Motor Corporation. That's where she met Stephen Mark Weisenhunt, an American from San Francisco who was 42 years old at the time. Stephen was a general manager of the Apex Motor Corporation and Elsa was in his team. And while they were both married to other people, just like in Lucila's case, both of them didn't choose wise decisions and had a relationship. People in their office eventually noticed, so Elsa resigned from Apex in April 1993 to let the rumors die. However, they still continued the affair for several more months. On September 23 the same year, Stephen asked his driver, Demetrio Ravelo, to pick up Elsa, who was then staying at her parents' house in Manila. Demetrio was instructed to bring Elsa to Stephen's condominium in Green Hills, and he just followed what his employer said and continued his day. That afternoon, Elsa even asked Demetrio to deliver a paper bag to her old office, and Stephen asked Demetrio to stay so he could drive Elsa back home by 10 p.m. According to court records, in Demetrio's sworn testimony, he waited in the building until 10 p.m., but he did not hear from either Stephen or Elsa, so he decided to go home. He then reported the next day to Stephen's unit as usual and mentioned that he saw Lucy, the house helper, looking for a knife. Demetrio claimed he overheard Stephen telling Lucy that he had the knife with him and that he even brought it out of his room. Demetrio was later sent out to buy cigarettes for Stephen. And at 5 p.m., he went home. The next day, after running some errands in Stephen's office, including picking up black plastic garbage bags, He returned to the condominium where he was instructed to drive Lucy home and prepare for an overnight trip to Bagak, Bataan, where Stephen's family owned a vacation home. When Demetrio returned, prepared to leave for the trip, Stephen asked a very strange question as a test of loyalty. He asked how long he was willing to work for Stephen. And when Demetrio replied he was willing to work for Stephen forever, Stephen broke down and confessed that Elsa was dead. Stephen said that Elsa died of bangungot. It's a nightmare death syndrome where the person experiences terrifying nightmare that could lead to unexpected death. I know this doesn't really happen in other places, but in the Philippines, since it's one of what they call culture-bound syndrome. In any case, bangungot just refers to the sudden death a person experiences while they are having nightmares. Back to the case. After hearing this, Demetrio suggested that Elsa's body be autopsied right away so that Stephen couldn't be blamed for her death. However, Stephen had already chopped up her corpse, so this was out of the question. Stephen further tested that Demetrio's loyalty by asking his help to pack up the corpse in garbage bags and then those inside luggage, which they later bought to Green Hills. Demetrio, who feared for his life, continued obeying Stephen's commands. They drove around Tagaytay and Batangas and headed toward Santa Rosa, Laguna. When they were near Putingkahoy in Silangan, Stephen ordered Demetrio to dump the bags with Elsa's dismembered body parts. They then drove towards Bataan, and on the way there, they would stop at highways to discard pieces of evidence, such as Elsa's garments and her other belongings. It was around midnight when they reached Stephen's house in Bataan. Demetrio claimed he wasn't able to sleep for fear that Stephen would also murder him. The next morning, they drove back to Manila. When Demetrio got home, he immediately told his family what happened. His wife convinced him to talk to the fiscal judge in their town, who later accompanied them to the Department of Justice. They were referred to the National Bureau of Investigation, and at first, the NBI authorities were doubtful of Demetrio's story, until a team of NBI agents headed to the place where Demetrio said he disposed of the body. When they arrived, they discovered that a group of tricycle drivers had already found the body and a crowd was beginning to gather as the agents arrived on the scene. They finally believed Demetrio. They then checked out the rest of Demetrio's confession and retrieved Elsa's belongings along the highway where he said they were discarded. They recovered everything, Elsa's belongings, her body parts, except for her genitalia. The NBI finally had the case and called on Stephen as the main suspect. He tried to defend himself in court, saying that the blood stains in his bedroom were actually period stains from his sister-in-law, and that Elsa died from bangungot, just like what he said to Demetrio. He even asked his lawyer doctor to testify in court. Since the court had its own medico-legal, they did an autopsy on Elsa's body and found out that Elsa did not die from bangungot, but from 3 stab wounds to the chest before being dismembered. Of course, Stephen lied, and we're not really surprised because if Elsa died from bangungot, why would he even chop the body? It doesn't make sense. On the following hearing sessions, Stephen claimed that he's been receiving the threatening letters from Fred, Elsa's estranged husband, in which the judge noted that the letters were directed at Stephen and not at Elsa. It was also revealed that Elsa apparently had reconciled with Fred a few days before her death. With these things being revealed, the judge perceived it as a motive for Stephen killing Elsa. The case was an open and shut case. On September 25, 1993, in a 35-page decision, Judge Ricardo Molina found Stephen Wisenhunt guilty of killing Elsa Castillo. He was sentenced to reclusion perpetua and was ordered to pay 100,000 pesos for the actual expenses for the funeral services and wake for 5 days, 3 million pesos for moral damages, 1 million pesos for exemplary damages, and 150,000 pesos for the attorney's fees. That's a total of 4,250,000 pesos, which was equivalent to 151,785 US dollars at that time. Because of both Lucila and Elsa's case, the story of the Chop Chop Lady became some kind of an urban legend and a cautionary tale for the wives and even women in general. In February of 2013, after 19 years of imprisonment in the Philippines, Stephen was finally deported to the USA to serve the rest of his sentence. The immigration official said that his life imprisonment sentence in 1993 was commuted because of good conduct while in prison. Huh. He's now blacklisted from returning to the Philippines. The immigration commissioner Ricardo David Jr. said in a statement, quote, "We have placed him in our blacklist so he could no longer return to the Philippines. His involvement in a gruesome crime makes him a very undesirable alien who should not be allowed to re-enter our country," unquote. And that was the tragic second case of the second Chop Chop Lady, Elsa Castillo. As much as we don't want this tragic case to repeat itself, unfortunately, 4 years after Stephen Wisenhunt was deported to the USA, the third Chop Chop Lady case happened. On January 7, 2017, a rucksack and a box containing the dismembered remains of a teenage girl were found along a road in Trece Martires, Cavite. The victim was Mitzi Joy Balunsay, who was only 17 years old at the time of the crime. Mitzi was just like any other teenager. She was full of hope, dreams, and a beautiful future ahead of her. Mitzi was an excellent student, so she was a scholar at the Cavite State University, a sophomore student taking up tourism. According to her friends and family, Mitzi was smart and a very talented dancer who was also an active member of their church. She was also a part of a theater group in her university. On January 5, 2017, she went to her university to enroll that semester. Later that night, her family received a text message from her number saying she hadn't finished enrolling and that she would be staying overnight at a friend's place. Her aunt immediately found the text message suspicious because the texting style was different. Her aunt had an inkling that the person who sent the text message wasn't her, because Mitzi always ends her text messages with, "I love you." The next day, she didn't go home, and her family started to get worried. 2 days later, the residents of Barangay de Ocampo in Trece Martires, Cavite, found the box with her dismembered body. They also found her ID and other documents, probably for enrollment, and the police identified her as the missing Mitzi. As soon as her body was found, the police immediately conducted an investigation in search for her murderer, and the suspect was immediately arrested for the crime not long after the body had been discovered. The killer was 20-year-old Alvin De Los Angeles, a schoolmate and orgmate of Mitzi. They were in the same theater group. Alvin came forward out of guilt. He claimed that he and Mitzi were in a relationship for 4 months. He said that Mitzi ended their relationship and, with the hope of getting back together, he invited her to his house. But according to Trece Martires Chief of Police Superintendent Egbert Tibayan, this wasn't true. Mitzi and Alvin weren't in a relationship. Instead, Alvin was just someone who was obsessed with Mitzi, who tricked her into coming to his house by asking that she pray for his deceased sister. In an interview with Scene of the Crime Operatives, or SOCO, which was a TV program in ABS-CBN Broadcast Network, Alvin said that he sort of blacked out and lost his mind when Mitzi allegedly didn't want to get back together with him. He said, quote, She didn't want to get back together, so I strangled her until she passed out. I raped her after that, I guess out of excessive love. When I came back to my senses, I didn't know what to do. I wanted to hide the crime, so I chopped her in the bathroom with a kitchen knife. End quote. The crime happened in Alvin's friend's apartment. After wrapping Mitzi's dried body parts, he even had the audacity to get 500 pesos or 9 US dollars from the victim's wallet and asked a tricycle driver to bring him to a secluded place where he could dump the body. He also admitted that he was the one who texted the victim's family on the night of January 5 and that he already sold Mitzi's phone. Since it was a straightforward confession, he was incarcerated right away and was charged with rape and homicide. Unlike the other cases, though, there wasn't a media frenzy about Mitzi's case because during this time, there were a lot of news about extrajudicial killings here in the Philippines. There were so many killings committed by the state that the public was already desensitized by the news. But of course, for Mitzi's family, this is a horror they won't forget. What's more heartbreaking is that Mitzi's mom, an overseas Filipino worker, went home to her lifeless daughter. Mitzi's mother, Marvic Balunsay, works as a domestic helper in Saudi Arabia with the hope of providing a better future for her daughter. Alvin begged them for forgiveness, but Marivic told TV Patrol, a news program in ABS-CBN, that there can be no mercy for such inhumane and merciless killing. On January 14 of the same year, a week after her wake, Mitzi's remains were finally laid to rest. During her funeral, her family and her friends gathered to remember her life, which was brutally cut short. These were such heartbreaking cases. Killing a person is already evil enough, but brutally dismembering them was another layer of evil. These people, no matter what their reasons are, really are a breed of monsters we wish didn't exist. Nobody has the right to cut another people's lives. And we hope that no one else will end up like Lucila, Elsa, and Mitzi. They are three wonderful women who once had bright lives ahead of them. And that ends episode 5. If you like this episode, please rate and make sure to subscribe and click the follow button. This podcast is available in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Please also follow our Instagram and Twitter accounts for updates on the next episodes. If there's a case you want me to cover, you can email me at monstersamongus2022@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you on the next episode for another true crime story. Bye!